Hey there, Bomb Squad. Welcome to The Future of Food, a Radio Cherry Bomb miniseries. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Throughout the series, you're going to hear talks and panels that we recorded on each stop, from Atlanta to Portland, Oregon, with chefs, farmers, bakers, activists, and even a rainbow pasta maker. These members of the Bomb Squad share their vision of what's next for them and for the world around them. I hope this series inspires you to stop and think about your future. For this episode, we traveled to the Midwest and stopped at the Lynn Hall in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Lynn Hall is part restaurant, part event space, and part incubator kitchen, and it's owned by our gracious host for the evening, Anne Spaeth. We're going to kick things off with a talk from Sarah Kiefer about what happens when your cookie recipe goes viral. Before we get the show on the road, let's check in with our sponsor. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our tour and this miniseries. Kerrygold is the iconic Irish brand known for its award-winning butter and cheese made with milk from grass-fed cows. Since Kerrygold gave us the opportunity to travel around the U.S. and hear from women all over the country, we thought it would be fascinating to take a virtual detour to Ireland to hear how some of their delicious products are made. One of the cheeses we love in particular is the award-winning Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. So we placed a call to Sarah Furno, a farmhouse cheesemaker who happens to know the history of how this very unique cheese came to be and who happened to create it.
Well, in the early 80s, what you did is you went to the library and you got a recipe book. So she went to the library and asked for a recipe book for making cheese. And it took 3 months to arrive because most people in Ireland weren't making cheese in the farmhouse kitchen. Maybe a bit of butter, but not cheese.
The she in the story isn't Sarah, but her mother, Jane Grubb, who invented the recipe for the famous Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese.
And she started experimenting in my granny's jam pan. Originally, she made hard cheddar-style cheeses. And then she thought, well, why not have a bit of fun and add a bit of spice in there? So she started making blue cheese. And she was the first person in Ireland to try to do that.
Want to try this groundbreaking blue cheese? Or maybe Kerrygold's savory shredded cheddar cheese? Or the garlic and herb butter? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com to check out the store locator and find out where you can purchase any of their award-winning cheese and butter. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. Does the world really need another chocolate chip cookie recipe? Apparently we do. When Sarah Kiefer of the Vanilla Bean blog introduced the world to her unique take on the classic, well, let's let Sarah tell the story. Please welcome Sarah Kiefer.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm just going to admit that I'm terribly nervous right now. I tend to write in stories, and so when I started to write what I was going to write tonight, it just kind of came out in story form. So I'm going to do what you're not supposed to do, which is read your notes, but I need to tonight. So that's what I'm going to do. Last September, I was pleasantly surprised to find a recipe from my cookbook make its way into the New York Times. The highlighted recipe was for a chocolate chip cookie that uses a technique now known as pan banging, you may have heard of this, where the baking sheet is tapped or banged in the oven while the cookies are baking, creating ridges and crinkles around the edges of the cookies. Although this has evolved and some people are actually taking them out of the oven and dropping them on the floor to get these ridges. Being in the New York Times food section was a bucket list item I never thought would happen, and I was ecstatic. A few days later, Fox News picked up the story, highlighting my cookie on all its local news outlets and online nationally. My pan-banging cookie had officially gone viral, and I like to point out that if both the New York Times and Fox are reporting on the same story, that it can't be fake news. That's my cheesy dad joke. I started getting emails and messages from people all over. My Instagram was full of people pan-banging their cookies and tagging me in photos. Local TV stations came to my house and filmed me making cookies. Newspapers called asking me questions, and I was flown out to New York to make cookies at an event. It was a whirlwind of a month, and I found myself, as one does on social media, addicted to the mentions, hearts, hashtags, and positive feedback. The question of how do I get my recipe to go viral started being posed to me, and I didn't have a good answer for anyone. There wasn't any formula or secret that I somehow cracked, and I like to think and hoped that it was because I had worked hard on making a cookie worth baking. But there was one element that kept it trending, and that was for as many people who loved this cookie and raved about it, there were also plenty of people who absolutely hated this cookie and thought it was ridiculous that it had been invented. The comment section to the New York Times under this recipe is filled with comments of people angry that these cookies exist. They are too greasy, too buttery, too big, too sweet, and people are furious about the pan banging. It's too time-consuming, it's not worth it, and my favorite complaint was that it was too loud. I had someone rant to me in an email about that. So while I had some good press and saw my Instagram follower count increase rapidly over the month my cookies went viral, I also had to process and accept that there were piles of people out there who hated what I was doing and maybe hated me for doing it. As someone who avoids conflict, has wrestled with being a people pleaser all my life, and has been diagnosed with anxiety and OCD, this set off a string of emotions. I could accept that my recipe wasn't for everyone, and I wasn't offended that someone wanted something different in a cookie. I always say, just as Carrie said, that there's always room in the world for more chocolate chip cookie recipes. But it was hard to accept that people would write off my whole career and hard work over a cookie, or that they assumed something of me because they didn't even like the picture of my cookie. I also had to deal with the press presenting me wrong. While I was flattered and so thankful to be included in the New York Times, my book wasn't mentioned and I didn't see any sales due to the article, both for not being mentioned and the recipe being available for free. They also highlighted my Instagram career over my book career. The local news had a headline that read, "Local Mom Gets in the New York Times." Also skipping over my career and presenting the idea that, you know, if this mom can get into the New York Times, anybody can do it. I was conflicted and frustrated that I couldn't control the narrative of my own recipe and story. I wanted to bake the cookies for everyone and try to prove they were good enough that I could bake and wasn't just some hack influencer who lucked out and that I knew what I was doing. I found myself obsessed about a cookie. I stopped reading comments on the news articles and on my blog, and I stopped answering questions about them in my messages and emails. I started actually regretting the cookies and their technique as I anxiously analyzed how many people viewed me through these cookies. Bloggers started posting their own versions of them, changing just a few ingredient measurements or sprinkling them with salt and calling them their own. Others tried to make the same cookie without all the fuss of pan banging. These new recipes were born from my original, but they weren't mine anymore, and I had no control over where things went. I started believing all the misconceptions I was worried about. I wasn't really a baker. Those cookies are clickbait. And I'm just a local mom who lucked out. It was actually in the act of parenting that I finally got over the weird spiral. My daughter was doing a report at school, and she needed to pretend to interview someone famous. As she was looking through a list of possible options, I slyly mentioned to her that, well, you know, your mom was in the New York Times. Maybe you could interview her. She didn't even look up from the paper she was reading and said, "Well, you weren't really in the New York Times, your cookies were. Maybe I could interview them." She's right over there too. I found myself laughing as I heard my ego crack in half. Oh my God, I am worrying about cookies. Yes, they are buttery and sugary and delicious as hell, but they can't bring clean water to Flint or stop the next school shooting. They won't give women equal pay or take the stigmatism away from mental health issues or remove the injustice of racism. They won't bring peace and only temporarily bring happiness. They can't even do the simple task of keeping people civil in the comment section of a newspaper article. I thanked my daughter for her honesty. I apparently needed a good dose of it. After that, I found myself pleasantly at peace with my cookies. They aren't really mine anymore. They belong to the pan bangers of the world, and I am thankful for each and every one of them. I still make them often. They are our house cookie, and each time I pick up the edge of my baking sheet and drop it 4 inches in my oven, I watch a ripple form around the edge of my cookies and know that those crispy edges and gooey, chocolatey centers will give me a moment of joy, but they do not define me, for it is only a cookie.
Thank you to Sarah Kiefer for sharing her story. If you haven't banged a pan and made those cookies, what are you waiting for? The recipe is in Sarah's wonderful cookbook, The Vanilla Bean Baking Book. She brought me a dozen of these cookies on the night of our event, and I've got to say, they were amazing. Our next speaker is Lensa Ahmed, the high school student who is also the CEO and CFO of the Green Garden Bakery. I don't know about you, but I wasn't the CEO of anything when I was in high school. Let's hear more from this inspiring young entrepreneur.
My name is Lensa. I'm 17 years old, and I am just finished my junior year in high school. So yes, I am the CEO and CFO of Green Garden Bakery. Green Garden Bakery, oh yeah. So we're a youth-run business. All of us are minority youth, so like all youth of color. We grow vegetables in our community garden, and we use those vegetables to make vegetable-based goods. We sell at farmers markets, we do pop-up sales, and we recently started online orders. So a third of our profits, we donate back into the community, which is a large part of our mission. Recently, we just won the Minnesota Cup, which is an entrepreneurship competition. Yeah. We have been featured in the Star Tribune and a lot of local newspapers recently. I would say that being a part of Green Garden Bakery has really changed my life. Learning more about nutrition and addressing the lack of food security in my neighborhood. I do live in North Minneapolis, so that's something that I really care about and want to help raise the community and better the community. Yeah, thank you.
We usually ask questions at the end, but because Lensa has to go, we're going to ask her some questions now. How can people in the audience get involved?
We have our website, greengardenbakery.org, so everyone can go on there and learn about how to get involved. We're always looking for ways to have adults be incorporated in our youth-run business, because that's sometimes, like, the lack of adult help sometimes is a struggle for us. And we're also on Instagram, GD Bakery MPLS, as well as Facebook. We have a Green Garden Bakery page.
Do you do any of the actual baking as CEO and CFO?
Sometimes when they need me, but most of the time, yeah. Most of the time, I probably do most of like the administrative work, I guess. I do like a lot of behind the scenes, as well as like the features in the media as well.
I don't know why we're sharing one mic when we have five mics, but that's okay. All right, so usually vegetables and desserts seem like they're in opposition to each other. So how are you blending the two? Tell us a few of the baked goods.
Yeah, so one of our best-selling baked goods that was just recently invented by one of the cooking classes that we run with the youth that are in there is our jalapeno chocolate chip cookie, which is really good. So it's like has kind of a kick at the end, but you can't really taste it. Another one of our vegetable-based goods is a lemon zucchini muffin, which is also really famous. That's my favorite, personally. So, like, most of the baked goods, you can't really taste the vegetables, and it's kind of a way to hide nutrition into foods for a lot of the youth, so it's pretty awesome.
And just tell us a little bit more about you. So I was asking you about your college plans. What's your future? What do you envision for yourself?
I'm kind of soul-searching right now. I have a lot of different possibilities for me. Like, I have, with Green Garden Bakery, there's a lot of different opportunities open for me. So I could go in anything from business to going into some type of STEM work. I could even, like, become a doctor. I don't know.
Awesome. Well, Lensa, thank you so much.
Thank you to Lensa and the Green Garden Bakers for making a difference in their community. As for Lensa, it sounds like her future is going to be a bright one. Before we get to the panel, let's return to my talk with farmhouse cheesemaker Sarah Furno, whose family created the award-winning Kerrygold Cashel Bleu Irish farmhouse cheese. I wanted to know more about Beechmount Farm, Sarah's family farm, so I asked her to tell us a little bit more about this magical place.
We have a lot of trees. That's why it's called Beechmount. We've got lovely deep soils here. It's a very traditional farming area in Ireland. And we've loads of small meadows on the farm and loads of hedgerows. The cows out in the fields. We've also got ponies and dogs and hens and all the things you'd expect to have on a farm. We live on the farm, so we want to keep it a nice environment to be in.
And in addition to the beautiful landscape, Sarah also has one of the best commutes.
Our farmhouse is in the middle of the farm, and then I don't have far to go to work. I've only got to go just across the farmyard and down at the cheese dairy.
It sounds like Sarah has the perfect situation to go with the perfect cheese. Want to try Kerrygold Cashel Bleu Irish Farmhouse cheese for yourself? Or maybe you'd like to try Kerrygold's famous butter or their new slices and shreds. Visit KerrygoldUSA.com to find a stockist near you. It's time to hear from our panel. We brought together five women who represent the Minneapolis food scene to hear their thoughts on the future. Let's welcome Chef Lachelle Cunningham of Shell's Kitchen, Melissa Coleman of the Faux Martha and the Minimalist Kitchen, Paku Hang, co-founder and executive director of the Hmong American Farmers Association, Chef Jamie Malone of the Grand Cafe, and Diane Mua, executive pastry chef of Belcour, Spoon and Stable, and Demi. We started the evening by asking Lachelle what comes to mind when she hears the phrase future of food.
When I think about the future of food, I think about how do we normalize healthy eating and how do we not just normalize healthy eating but make it accessible to all of everyone in our community, and how do we really reconnect to our food? We've been talking about this for years, reconnecting to our food. Where does our food come from? But really, food is the great equalizer. And so I believe that when we can unite under that common interest and we can see that what we put into our bodies and what we consume into our lives has a great impact on us individually, but us as a community of people, I think that that is really where we need to go in our food system. We've done a lot of work. We talk about sustainability. We talk about all these kind of jargon words, and they're great things, and we need to keep moving towards that, but we really need to understand the impact of our health on what we ingest. And I think that our future is bound to that, and it's imperative that we really unite around that. So that's what I'm talking about.
Great. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Melissa? I hope the future of food is centered around dinner time. It's so simple. It's this ancient, ordinary, humble practice of gathering around the table. And our lives have almost become too busy to gather, too busy to cook. I met with a couple people when I was doing my book tour, and I was talking to two people, and one person said, "Oh, I hope you have quick recipes." I was like, "Yeah, I have those." And then the person standing next to them said, "Well, I want slow recipes. I want to cook. I want to spend time in my kitchen." I said, "Oh, I have those too." But it just made me realize we don't spend our lives are too busy for food, for the dinner tables, for something as simple as gathering. And I hope that we can carve time out for that. That it's sacred time.
I think there's two things that's happening, right? There's a bifurcation, and when you talk about like what is future food, I think there's a bifurcation that's happening. On one hand, we're going into food that is thinking about feeding the world, and so they're looking at whether it's GMO foods, or seeds, or precision technology, ways to create food that can be mass produced and shipped out, and it can be grown in one part of the world, and then 2 weeks later be in another part, and supposedly it tastes better. And there is a space for that, right? I mean, I may not agree with it, but there is a space, and there's a whole industry around that, and more power to them. But I also think, and this is for me, I think where the future is that there is a growing awareness of who is growing our food, who is cooking our food, the memories that our food and the flavors evoke in us, and just a greater awareness of how food is really the medium from which we're connecting with people. And I think about that often because in my life, I'm an immigrant. I was born in a refugee camp. And growing up, my parents wanted to send us to Catholic school, but we couldn't afford it. So we started, picking cucumbers and then selling at the farmer's market. And I remember vividly when I was in sixth grade, we were picking cucumbers, and that was like 1986 or 87. It was an extremely hot year. And I remember as a sixth grader thinking, like, no, global warming is for real. I don't know if anybody's ever picked cucumbers, but they're so prickly. You have to wear gloves. You have to wear these like washing gloves. And I was thinking, God, this is for real. And that was for me the motivation to like, I'm like, if I can't win the lottery, I'm going to get a good education because there's no way that I'm ever going to do this for life, which is really ironic because now as my role at the Hmong American Farm Association is to tell the stories of farmers. And I do think people often say, you know, could this have been done maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago? And I said, I don't think so, because we're at this nexus right now where people are open to these ideas, and they're especially open to the holistic way of thinking about food. And I do think that is something that's growing, and I really hope that that is the future, because I think that's the only way that we're going to be able to sustain ourselves.
So I'll talk about food in the context of restaurants, which makes me feel a little out of place on this panel, because I think a lot of people here are doing things that are more meaningful than what we do, which is a little bit topical sometimes. But I'm hoping that food within the context of restaurants starts to change. I think there's a lot of focus on what's on the plate, what it looks like, who cooked it. And I think, you know, to your point about dinner being sacred, I think I love the idea of cooking in homes and home cooking, but I also love the idea of restaurants. A restaurant can be a commissary for a neighborhood, for a community, so it can be good environmentally, but it can also be good for communities. For me, the future of food in restaurants is a shift from an egotistical kind of chefy focus onto being able to be vulnerable and serving food, cooking food. It's an act of love, and for us to really remember that that's what it's about and that's what we're doing, and that's also just as sacred as dinner time. I mean, I think a lot about how in our restaurant we have the opportunity to celebrate humanity and really kind of like, to me, the top of civilization, which is dining, and how lucky we are. And I just think there's something magical about it, and it's a chance where we get to connect. But most of all, I hope that we can move towards being able to be more vulnerable, and it's a place where we can show other human beings how much we care about them.
Hi, everyone. One, I failed speech class, okay? Two, if I get teary eye, I'm really allergic to flour, and I'm a pastry chef. And so I'm short of a head baker, so if you guys know anybody, send them my way to Belcour. So I've been baking bread in the morning, so I'm still like teary eye from that. But future of food to me, I have 2 points. They're very personal to me. One, I have 2 kids, and it's teaching them about, I don't know, I'm in the food field and they still don't know. Lily, my daughter, she's 13, and 3 years ago she learned that chicken nuggets came from chicken. So educating my kids, I mean, I can't educate anybody else until I can educate my kids about where our food comes from. I really think that nowadays a lot of kids don't know where their food is coming from. So my main goal is, once I stop working so much, is I want to educate kids of where food comes from. My parents have a farm in Wisconsin, and we go there. And every time I go, my mom has a saying that every time you go, an animal dies. Because my dad always loves to, there's a duck or there's a pig, and there's something fresh on the dinner, because I only go there once a year. They live in Wisconsin. So my sister is really against about letting her kids see the whole butchering part, but I want my kids, everybody has a preference. I want my kids to know where her chicken nuggets come from. I want her to know where everything comes from beef, cow, chicken, unless you're a vegetarian. I mean, everyone needs to know where their food comes from. I really think nowadays, a lot of people don't know where their food comes from. And another thing, food, the future is, one, I'm not for females up here. I'm talking about, like, let's bring males and females to the same level. Because I feel like once you get those two together, like, I mean, you see all these pastry competitions, all male. All male. And I've thought about why it's all male, but I don't think I could do it because I have kids and you have to study. You really have to have no life. Not that you don't have to have life, but if you have kids, you're a mom, and you have more chores at home. But if we bring this equality up, imagine how far women can go too. We can go just as far as male. So to me, there's 2 points of the food of future for me is educating kids, especially my kids, where their food come from, and teaching them that my daughter Lily can be just as equal as Thomas. That's me.
Thank you. So Diane, in very basic terms, told us what she's doing to sort of put some of this change into action. Lachelle, we're going to go back to you. Can you tell us just a few things? I mean, you do a lot, so maybe just tell us one thing. But tell us one thing you're doing to bring about some of the change that you'd like to see.
I am really making it my purpose and a part of just what I do to really celebrate plants and vegetables and what's healing that's coming out of our backyard that we think about as weeds or things that actually can help us medicinally. So that's something personally for me. But I also do work. I think for me and the community that I serve, my community is this Twin Cities, but specifically for me, I serve the community that I most identify with it, which is the African American community, specifically in the food industry. And what I do is I like help other entrepreneurs in this business. And it has to do with just sometimes just inspiring someone with what I do, but also it's with helping people that are looking to build a business. I'm really about entrepreneurship and creating an ecosystem that will help us on the level of business as well as food. And so my purpose is to impact people through food. And so I start there, but I do a lot of work. I'm teaching. I have a curriculum called Healthy Roots, which I teach around the history of soul food and really reclaiming the narrative around soul food, but also looking deeper into how that really impacts our bodies and our lives and our kind of trajectory. And then I also teach food safety and some other things around that. But my biggest impact, I think, is helping entrepreneurs and really showing that we can make money in this industry and it's not just a $10 an hour job. And I think that was one of my biggest things when I came into the food industry is everyone's like, you're going to make $10 an hour. And I'm like, you might make $10 an hour, but I think I'm one of those, and I'm embracing the fact that I'm a kick down the door type of person. And yeah.
Melissa, how about you?
Yeah, my answer is twofold. Number one, I wrote a book. Dinner time broke for me. I couldn't figure out how to get dinner on the table. I knew that I wanted us to gather as a family, that I wanted to create that ritual where we came to the table every night. Sometimes I'm a little nutty, but I look at food and I just imagine it screaming at me like, stop, gather, eat, slow down. Nothing else matters, at least for a second. So I wrote a book so that I would actually cook, and it works. It works in my family. It might not work in your family, but it works in my family. It's a practical solution to an everyday problem, which is dinner time. I remember standing right after I had my daughter, I'd look up at the popcorn ceiling and just pray that dinner time was gonna fall out of the popcorn ceiling, or at least an idea. Like, I would have taken an idea. I had nothing at 5:30. But to kind of ping pong off what Diane said, I was at the end of my book tour. My husband was actually with me at this part, and we're in the car in LA traffic, and I'm like, this is why I live in Minneapolis. Why am I in LA? But I was like, I'm gonna let this idea that's been sitting inside that no one else has heard of come out. And it was met with laughter, as most of my ideas are. And I said, Kevin's my husband, Kevin, I want to develop curriculum. I'm gonna need a politician. I wanna develop curriculum to bring food back into schools. I think we need to educate people about food, just for the same things. I came to food because I loved food. I loved to eat. And so then I learned to bake because I loved to eat, and then I had to feed myself dinner, so I learned to cook myself dinner. But nowhere was it really taught to me except Martha Stewart. While working out. Yes, but I learned it because I loved it, and not everybody loves it. Not everybody loves to be in the kitchen. And so many days, me who loves food, I don't want to be in the kitchen, especially at 5:30 when I have no ideas and the popcorn ceiling isn't producing. So this is my dream. I would like to team up with you if you're interested, and anyone else we're going to need a politician. But I would love to create a curriculum and bring food education back into schools. Same with mental health. We kind of skip over in our education system. We teach people mathematics, and now we're teaching them robotics and all these high-level thinking things, but we don't even know how to take care of our bodies. We don't know what to put in them. We don't know how to deal with the emotions of being lonely, because everybody feels the emotions of being lonely. And I would love for us just not to skip over the little things, the simple things, the everyday things, the sacred things that make us who we are, so we can do the big things like robotics. But how do we feed ourselves? Where does food come from? I taught my daughter to eat everything from the dirt, and then I had to start teaching her, like, oh, we don't eat that, but you can eat that, we don't eat that. But I want her to understand that produce doesn't come from a shelf at the grocery store, because that's where I thought it just magically appeared from there. So I'd like to team up with you if you're interested. This is not Shark Tank, but.
I can see a super group emerging here of Lachelle, Melissa, and Diane doing some education programs. And if there are any politicians out there, talk to these ladies afterward. All right. Your turn.
So what am I doing, right? So I co-founded an organization called Among American Farm Association. We work with over 100 farmers, and our mission is to lift up Hmong farmers and build economic prosperity. And we do that basically based on three tenets, right? We wanted people to self-determine. And so, like, what does that mean, right? We wanted people to have agency or power over their own stories and the food history of their lives and what they were taught. And we wanted them to get credit for it and not just be like the sidekick where someone else is talking about like bean sprouts or Hmong bitter melon. And so that was the first thing. The second thing is that we wanted to have systems change. And we did that around a membership. So in order for a farmer to belong to HAFA, they have to join our membership. And it's just it's a small fee, but it was this idea that we wanted people to recognize that what they were facing in the food system, it was not something about them, but there was something inherently wrong in the system. And we wouldn't be able to tackle those problems unless we were a group. If there are systems problems, we have to have system solutions. And then thirdly, we were about wealth, not just income. And there's this great economist who says that, you know, income is awesome, right? Because it feeds my stomach. But what I really want is wealth, because wealth feeds my mind. And when my mind is healthy and fair, I can imagine what will I do in 5 days or 5 years or 50 years from now, and then my behavior changes because of that. And so what are we doing at HAFA, right? We're trying to build a voice for Hmong farmers so that they can build intergenerational wealth and lift up not only themselves and their families, but their community. And lastly, we want to change the food system. And let me just give you one example of how we're trying to do that. So we work very closely with healthcare companies. In particular, we were working with HealthEast. And HealthEast, if you live in St. Paul, HealthEast has a hospital called St. John's. 40% of St. John's patients are Hmong. And so we were talking, and there was this physician, Dr. Letts. And he was like, you know, I'm getting so many Karen and Burmese refugee patients, and they're so depressed because many of them were in the refugee camps for 10, 20 years. And so we came up with this idea that we would start these CSAs. They're called VeggieRx. But unlike traditional VeggieRx, these VeggieRx boxes would be customized towards a Southeast Asian diet. And we started off with just five families that Dr. Letts and some of his physician colleagues had identified were food insecure. And he said he had, in particular, one patient who he'd been treating for like 10 years, and this man was severely depressed. And he said the first time that he got one of these VeggieRx boxes, the man went in and he lifted up one of these cucumbers, and he smelled it. He said, this is the smell. This is the smell of my country. And he started crying, right? And Dr. Letts says, all my time that I've treated this man, he'd never had any type of affect, and this was the first time that I saw him. And that was just 2 years ago, and now we're serving 100 families in this VeggieRx program, right? And we believe that if insurance companies are so concerned, if insurance companies want to be preventative, and if they will subsidize health club, you know, membership, why can't they subsidize CSAs, right? And if we want healthy food for our kids, especially like if we're concerned about obesity or diabetes, why don't we just have 2 cents more for every lunch in Minnesota, right? Every public school who makes a commitment to buying from local farmers, if they can just, the state could just give them 2 cents more on their lunches, that would be a way that we could not only have healthy food year-round for the kids, but also support, you know, immigrant farmers and local farmers.
Wow, that's amazing. Puku, for those who don't know anything about the Hmong community here, can you tell us something?
Sure, I can, and then Diane, you can jump in too. Okay. Who I've always wanted to meet you, so this is so awesome. Panel. I read your New York Times article, and I was like, oh my God, you're such a star.
Now you are, now you are second generation Hmong, correct?
Hmong, that's
and
right,
you
yeah.
are first generation, right?
Yeah. So the Hmong are hill people, ethnic people from parts of Southeast Asia. They're just kind of like the Kurds. They straddle many national borders. And during the Vietnam War, part of a secret operation with the CIA partnered up with the United with the Hmong soldiers. And there were the parts of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So if people know, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was like the supply line that really North Viet Cong were using to move their supplies up and down, and up and down Vietnam. And there's a section of it that goes into Laos. And so the CIA had Hmong soldiers, some as young as 14, patrolled that part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then technically, the United States was not supposed to be in Laos. But what they would often do is they would bomb parts of Vietnam, parts of Cambodia, and they would then eject themselves out of the airplanes in Laos. And Hmong soldiers were then asked to go and rescue these American soldiers. So after the Vietnam War, the communist faction in Laos came into power. And the first people that they began to target into re-education camps were Hmong families. And so Diane and myself, our families were part of that mass exodus of Hmong folks in Laos trying to get out of Laos. And now, you know, these are people who, for their whole lives, like, they had never left their villages, right? And now they're Hmong people in French Guiana, in Denmark, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Germany, in Canada, in Minnesota, in the United States. So we're a diaspora now because of the war.
Yeah. Thank you. Jamie, so you talked about changing kitchen culture somewhat. So, so I'm curious, now that you have your own kitchen to run and get to shape sort of everything, tell us what you're doing.
Well, actually, can we switch spots so I don't have to keep going after you? Then you can sit by Diane, it'll work out. My work feels meaningless.
We need restaurants. We need chefs. We need restaurants. The farmers need restaurants.
It's really easy to get overwhelmed when you see all of the things that you want to change in the world. And my personal ethos has always been, if I can make a commitment to make small changes to the connections that, you know, I have on a daily basis, that's a really good start. You know, we try to do those starts in the kitchen. And Britt St. Clair, who's here, who actually runs the kitchen on a day-to-day basis at the Grand Cafe. So if you've had a good meal there, you can thank Britt.
And I should tell people, we wanted to do this on a Monday because Grand Cafe is closed on Mondays. So we knew Jamie wouldn't have that much of an excuse to not be here. So.
Thank you for accommodating that. You know, we try to, like I had mentioned, for a lot of reasons at the Grand Cafe, we try to pull the focus away from the food. It doesn't mean that we work any less hard on the food or give it any less, you know, reverence, but we try to change the focus on it. And, you know, I'm running a kitchen, but I'm also running a whole restaurant and a whole staff. And a lot of what we focus on is the service and really truly making sure that we're not just saying, you know, come to the Grand Cafe for a fabulous chicken breast or whatever, but we want the whole restaurant and, you know, sorry if we've ever failed anyone in this, but our desire is to have it really be an oasis from everyday life and have it be a place where you can stop and you can pause, and not only can we find a way to connect with you and maybe be a little bit vulnerable and show you love in small ways, but you can do that with the people you're dining with. I think it's incredibly important. In my family growing up, the times that we really stopped, the world stopped, and we connected was at restaurants. We ate a lot at home, but it was at restaurants where the world stopped, and it was about family. So the idea of being able to provide that for other people is really important to us, and we do it in small ways. You know, all the times we're talking about service, we're talking about how can we be polished, how can we show we care, but how can we be non-intrusive and allow intimate, special experiences. And a big part of that is trying not to make a big focus of it be the food, you know. Hopefully the food is so good you can just think about your friends or whatever. But you know, we had a big, you know, staff meeting, all manager meeting this morning, and we were talking about how can we create an environment where no one is embarrassed to say I don't know or I fucked up, where that's like, I make mistakes, Britt knows this, and like basically my whole day is just a series of mistakes that I'm apologizing for. I make them constantly and I try to be really open about it. I try not to hide it. But man, in restaurants, it's so hard. It's like, to say you made a mistake, it's really terrifying. And you know, you might have spent every day for the last 2 years at your last restaurant job peeling asparagus. You come to the Grand Cafe, we peel it a little bit differently, but for some reason there's all this shame wrapped up, and like somehow you magically don't know how we peel asparagus here, and it's like this huge weird mentality. And so we're just trying to create an environment where, of all the stress that restaurant people have to deal with, hopefully that's one thing that we can take off their plate. And
Diane, what are some other things you're doing? I mean, you are in a big kitchen, a big, busy kitchen. I read you do like 200 plus covers every single night. What are you doing to change the kitchen culture?
I have a really good team. I have a really good, a few good mentors. I have Gavin Kaysen, I have Allison, who, I don't know, I run to every day. But I really feel like we're running into a shortage of cooks. And, you know, I tell my sous chef this, how can we educate? How can we bring more people in and educate them? Because I seriously don't understand how people are opening restaurants right now, because there's so much of a shortage out there. So everybody that we bring in, we're, our teaching days nowadays are different. I remember when I was just a pastry cook, and I remember I was crying because I was just getting yelled at, and she'd be like, are you crying? I'm like, no, it's my allergies. But I was just like, I would tough it up, right? I would totally tough it up, and I knew I had a goal, and I, you know, I had my son, you know, so I couldn't get to work early. I couldn't be like every cook who got there 2 hours early. But the generation is changing. So we as chef needs to change and deal with this. I mean, our kids nowadays, they're learning at school differently. We're all learning differently. So how can we educate cooks that are coming in that it's not a scary place? That it's okay. I mean, Spoon and Stable is a beast. It's crazy. I told Alex, my sous chef who's here tonight, I'm like, I can't keep up. I'm way too old to work at the line there. Every time I work there, I feel like I'm getting beat up all the time. But it's so great to have such a great team who works behind you, and they're wanting to learn how to work faster and more efficient. And I want to bring more people in. And you know, we've had a lot of stagers who, you know, next month, I think the end of the month, we have a lady who wants to do a career change. She wants to stage 2 weeks with us, 2 weeks at Belcor, just to see how it is before she does a career change. I'm like, come on in. I don't think of it. I mean, way back then, we're like, oh, yeah, free labor. Now I'm like, no, come on in, see what we do, because it's not glamorous. It's really not. I mean, we're sweating all day. I mean, this is my best outfit I can find. I can't even keep up with fashion anymore because I'm in black pants and chef coats, t-shirt all the time. It's my comfort zone. So I want all the high school kids, we have a lot of high school kids come in, and I just want, it's not that bad in the kitchen. It is to a certain extent, but if you're willing to work hard, there's always a way.
And we do have some culinary school, future culinary school students in here. Spring, where are you? I'm going to embarrass Spring now. All the way in the back. Spring is starting culinary school in the fall. So who knows? Maybe we'll see her at the Grand Cafe or at Spoon and Stable.
It's not that
one
bad.
One of these days. All right, so this is going to be a speed round because there's still a lot of food and a lot of mingling, and we want the audience to be able to ask some questions. So Lachelle, 10 years ahead, the year 2028. What's one thing you envision for yourself?
I really see barriers being broken. I see a real community around food, around creating an ecosystem that is around food, economics, education, and really healing.
Thank you. Where will the Faux Martha be in 2028?
I was listening to, I'm pretty infatuated with Oprah's podcast, Super Soul Conversations, Will I Am. Have you guys listened to that one? You need to go home and listen to it. I've listened to it twice in like the past 3 days. But he said, Oprah said, why aren't you making music anymore? And he was like, well, I've made my music. I've paid my dues. Now I'm reinvesting in other people. Why do I need to stay in this to just to make music? I don't want to make music just to make music. And so I, back to the education piece, I love to give back, pour into someone else, the next generation. And for the food world, I hope that we are more literate, that we are food literate, and that extends beyond this community, beyond the food community, that it's a language that we all have and that we all know how to feed ourselves well.
So in 10 years, I hope that lemongrass and like bitter melon are just as common as part of the Minnesota, right, Minnesota palate as lutefisk is. And for me personally, I hope to be growing plum and pears and making plum wine and pear wine. That'd be fun.
For me in 10 years, my favorite part of my life is working in restaurants. There's a lot of hard parts, but you work with the salt of the earth. So I hope I continue to get to be around the greatest people in the world. And I hope that my organization can continue to be successful and become profitable. And I can, you know, pay them all what they deserve. I look at them every day and look at them sweating and burning themselves and so earnestly trying their absolute hardest. And I'm just like, I wish I could give you $1 million, but here's $15 an hour. So I hope that I get to continue to be surrounded by them, but I hope when I look at them, I feel that they're supported in living the healthy, happy lives that they deserve.
10 years from now, gosh, I don't even know about next year. Being first generation Hmong, I mean, everything I talked about today is kind of personal, but I want to see this whole male domination thing to go to, and I want it to be all equal. That's what I want to see, is all across the board in the kitchen. I found myself a little bit more now in the kitchen. You know, the kitchen's bringing my true self out, and I really believe, like, being Hmong, like, the male domination is so high up, and my goal is, in order to attack, I mean, I can't attack everything at once. I have to do one thing at once, and my thing is to show my daughter and show my son that everyone's equal.
Diane, we couldn't agree more. Our show was produced by Jess Seidman and supported by Kerrygold. Thank you to Anne Spaeth and the team at the Lynn Hall for hosting us. And thank you to all of our speakers and to the amazing members of the Bomb Squad who joined us for this taping. While we were in town, we had dinner at Jamie Malone's Grand Cafe, and we got snacks and drinks at a very unique place called the Gist Fermentation Bar. We highly recommend you visit those places, as well as the Lynn Hall. Be sure to support the women in your community. Thank you for listening to the Future of Food miniseries. Here's to a delicious tomorrow.